Hello and welcome to Continent of Media, number 0604, also to be known later as World of Radio Extra 68. I'm Glenn Hauser with his more or less monthly program about media around the American continent, not necessarily shortwave. Continent of Media is made possible by Universal Radio. Check their website, www.universal-radio.com. or call for a catalog at 1-800-431-3939. Universal Radio for quality amateur and shortwave equipment, which also sponsors www.dxing.com, including audio access to this program. There's been a lot of media news from Mexico, which hasn't received the attention it deserves north of the border. So first, several items about Mexico. John Kellerman in Texas, who specializes in DXing Mexican medium wave station, says the March edition of the Directory of Audiovisual Services in Mexico discloses that the operators of XEMQ 8-10 have converted it into La Estación Comercial en Lengua Maya. This has been a Radio Formula outlet, but in 2004 it became La 810, Activando Tu Mente. But now its name is YOL-IK, which is spelled Y-O with an accent O-L-I-I-K. The company translates this to Esencia de Viento, the essence of wind. It's in Mérida, Yucatán, at the same address as several other stations in the group, on 970, 95.3, 680, and 930. It's 2 kilowatts, scheduled from 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. local time. This is supposedly the first all-Maya language radio station in Mexico, although no doubt there are many that carry some Maya. And by the way, that same group used to have a shortwave station on 6105 with the call letters reversed, XEQM. From the CGC communicator via Kevin Redding, ABDX, an FCC notice that an application has been accepted for XEKAM to receive cross-border program feeds. That's 960 kilohertz in Nuevo Laredo, Tamaulipas. I think this had been a very Mexican station until now, but it seems they'll be getting programming from the U.S., possibly in English if this is approved. Artie Bigley forwards a story in English from El Universal. March 30th, public radio plays the same song all day in protest. 17 stations of the Mexican Radio Institute, which used to include shortwave XERMX, are playing the same song over and over all day long to protest a new federal telecommunications bill being reviewed in the Senate. The bill had generated great controversy around the nation, in particular among small AM broadcasters, who say the passage of the law would hurt them more than Mexico's large media groups, among them Televisa and TV Azteca. Public network IMER expressed its disagreement, saying its stations would play the same song all day on that particular day because a country without plurality of the communications media would be like hearing the same song all day. The statement said if the law is approved, Channel 11, 22, Radio Educación, the IMER group, and all the university, state, indigenous, and community radio and TV stations would be without the basic conditions to fulfill their social function. One IMER station, Reactor 105.7, had been playing the song continuously and repeating the phrase, "You dance this rhythm backwards," followed by reading a statement protesting the law. The law, which was approved in December by the lower house of Congress, unleashed a wave of criticism focused on the assertion that it strengthens control of the industry by private TV networks and does not foster competition. If the bill is approved, public radio stations could disappear, said IMER. Another story, in Spanish, was titled A Merced de los Políticos, at the mercy of the politicians. It appeared in the magazine Etc. April issue by Fernando Mejia Barquera. This is about a university station in Aguascalientes, XEUAA, which had decided that it would turn off its AM 1370 station and concentrate on FM 94.5 XHUAA. Like in the U.S., it's not unusual for a university to have both an AM and FM station, But in this case, apparently the Secretariat of Communications was against that university operating two stations. Now, there's a lot more politics involved in this. The university had decided that operating an FM station would require fewer workers, and were firing 40% of the staff, furthermore changing the format to juvenile music. Roberto Edgar Gomez Morales forwarded that story to Noticias de X, and you can also read it in DX Listening Digest 6070 via worldofradio.com. In fact, you may read more about all the stories on this program somewhere in recent issues of DX Listening Digest. You'll find a summary and the reference to each issue via worldofradio.com. Look for the file of World of Radio and Continent of Media Summaries for 2006. Jilly Dibka sends a story from the Washington Times, Mooney, April 19th, by Jennifer Harper, Radio Free Mexico, Eyed to Prevent Migration. If Jack Wheeler gets his way, airwaves south of the border will be filled with reasons for potential illegal aliens to stay in their country and prosper. He says this is ultimately the only way to end the invasion of Mexican illegals, create a successful Mexico. He announced plans to privately raise $500 kilodollars in startup funds for RFM, a new broadcast system featuring Spanish programming with a Yankee capitalist slant. He's a former Reagan administration geopolitical analyst, convinced he has a ready audience among frustrated Mexicans eager to undo the poverty that drives them north. The goal of Radio Free Mexico is to change the culture of Mexico from corrupt poverty to lawful wealth. With an eventual 24-hour broadcast in mind, Wheeler plans to buy radio airtime in Mexico City, Monterrey, and other cities for specials or one-time broadcasts. Several contributors had already pledged six figures to the fledgling RFM. He'll post info about the project on his conservative news website, www.tothepointnews.com. I find it difficult to take this Radio Free Mexico idea seriously. After all, isn't Mexico free despite its problems? The name is hardly appropriate. It shows a serious lack of imagination. Why not call it Radio Benito Juarez? Here's another project, no doubt unrelated, which Kim Andrew Elliott tells us about, thanks to a story in the Sports and Outdoors section of the April 29th San Diego Union-Tribune, dropping shortwave radios on Mexico. An organization called Mercy Wings has dropped off thousands of shortwave, solar-powered radios that are tuned to a Spanish-speaking gospel station in Ohio. The radios flutter down to remote villages hanging from a parachute. Trouble is, there is no shortwave broadcast station in Ohio. It might be a program produced in Ohio and transmitted on another private U.S. station. The airdrop radios are fixed-tune models manufactured by Galcom International. The model is called GOYE, G-O-Y-E. But because shortwave stations often change frequencies, fixed-tune receivers might not be practical. Half-baked idea, it seems to be, but no doubt appealing to the ignorant faithful. Here's a story, an obituary, from the Washington Post, April 2nd, about Robert Wilkinson, called a CIA radio manager. He died at the age of 89 in McLean, Virginia. He was born in Catamarca, Argentina, son of a civil engineer, educated around the world. While in Hollywood in the early 20s, as a youngster, he appeared in several movies, including some of the Our Gang series, did voiceover work, and graduated from Berkeley. His family moved to Cuba in 1942, worked as a radio actor, playing the role of El Fantasma in one of the more popular serials of the time. In 1951, he became a TV producer and director of Cabaret Regalias, a variety show that was the top-rated program on Cuban TV for 11 years. And he later produced the Cuban version of This Is Your Life. In 1960, Wilkinson joined the CIA, and while in Miami, became general manager of Radio Americas, which transmitted news, political commentary, and entertainment to Cuba. I should point out that it was earlier known as Radio Swan. The station abruptly closed in 1968, and Wilkinson moved to Washington before being sent to Spain as a covert agent for 4 years. His last 4 years as a full-time employee, before retiring in 76, were spent training other CIA personnel. where he stayed until 1990. Thanks to Mike Cooper for sending on that story. Looking at the website of Radio Reloj, one of the Cuban government networks, I found an interesting page explaining the air shifts and how the announcers take their breaks to recuperate. That's the station which gives a time check every minute with a continuous ticking clock every second. Meanwhile, news headlines are fitted in. It says, as I translate on the run, the human voice, live, is present 24 hours a day on Radio Reloj. The announcer has a four-hour shift, three of those before the microphone, in which he may read 15,000 words. After 1 hour of reading news, the announcer takes a half hour off and then comes back for another hour and rests another half hour. After that, he finishes his final hour before the microphone. There are two announcers at a time. They take turns reading paragraphs. And during the half hour rest period, a third announcer comes in and substitutes for the one resting. And then they exchange positions. It's all very organized, as you might expect. And furthermore, the webpage gives the full name of every announcer on their staff, 32 of them. Dean McIntyre in Alberta forwards CRTC item about a new X-band AM station approved for Toronto on 1690. With 1 kilowatt, unlimited, it's for a mostly Greek-language station. It'll have some programming in Armenian, Romanian, Serbian, and Bulgarian, as well as English. It's owned by the Canadian Hellenic Toronto Radio Incorporated. It has a single tower at 450 Comstock Road, Scarborough, to the east of downtown Toronto. I suppose it's not on the air yet. Call letters not assigned, but keep an ear on 1690 for that new Toronto station. CBC decimates design department, announces 79 layoffs in Toronto, is the headline April 20th of a story from the Canadian Media Guild via Ori Siegel, ODXA. The closing of CBC's design department is a big mistake. It marks the end of the public broadcaster's ability to produce its own TV programs in-house, according to Canadian Media Guild leaders. Lise Leroux, national president, says the CBC is also preempting the government mandate review and public input by taking this action now. It's been reported that Heritage Minister Bev Oda wants to move quickly to launch a review. CBC says it'll save a megadollar per year by killing the design department and keeps referring to layoffs as another business decision. This is really about people and their lives. In this case, people have contributed many years of first-rate service to make CBC look wonderful on the air. When these people walk out the door for the last time, they'll be taking with them the long and celebrated tradition of high-quality television design in Canada. This is a hell of a price to pay to save $1 million out of a $1.6 billion budget. By the end of the summer, CBC will no longer be able to design sets or make costumes, props, or special effects in what has been the center of TV production. Employees were told that the design department would be sold off in July. It's likely the CBC will try to use whatever savings may come from the demise of the Toronto Design Department to buy more programs from outside producers. Don Ferguson, member and co-creator of Royal Canadian Air Force, says this marks the end of the dream. One of the reasons we stayed with CBC is that everything is in this building. We get a script on Monday, we design and build all the sets and costumes through the week, and we are on the air Friday. It's the proximity of everything that makes this so special. Mike Cooper sends an AP story of April 13th. The Philadelphia Orchestra, which has lacked a regular presence on national radio for nearly a decade, will have a series of concerts on NPR. All are part of 26 previously recorded concerts from the 2005-06 season will be broadcast on SymphonyCast and Performance Today. It's a one-year agreement expected to be renewed. The orchestra and its unionized musicians agreed on fees for the broadcasts produced by NPR and WHYY. Philadelphia Orchestra has not been heard on national broadcasts since 1997-98. It was the first orchestra with its own commercially sponsored national radio series beginning in 1929 on NBC. NPR's Performance Today, 2 hours every weekday, carries a variety of shorter performances from many different sources, but SymphonyCast carries complete symphony concerts. However, Philadelphia will be taking turns with others. I've checked their website and see that Philadelphia was scheduled on May 28th and June 18th, so it's maybe once or twice a month. However, stations have the option of playing the program anytime during the following 2 weeks, so you need to look up the exact timing and scheduling on the public radio station you listen to. You can do that easily at publicradiofan.com. I'm also pleased to find that the Santa Fe Chamber Music Festival is again being broadcast. It had no publicity, but I ran across it on the current schedules of a few public radio stations. No doubt there are many more, but I haven't been able to locate a list either at the SantaFeChamberMusic.org website or at WFMT, the syndicator. Nor am I sure if it's only a 13-week series starting in April or a longer one. I heard one show from the summer 2004 season, so they've been saving up recordings, and no doubt they could run for much more than 13 weeks of one-hour concerts. In any event, some stations I have found it on, and these are UT Days and Times, Sunday at 1400 on KXMS in Joplin, Missouri, but it's low-fidelity webcast, Sunday at 1730 on KTEP in El Paso, and UT Monday at 0200 on KSUI in Iowa City. Thanks to Tom Roche for sending on a long story from Columbia Journalism Review titled Out of Thin Air by Daniel Schulman. It's about how all those satellite-fed gospel huckster FM translators came about, polluting our FM bands. Something called Radio Assist Ministry started in 2002. It's also about trafficking in translator applications or grants. In March 2003, the FCC was deluged with more than 13,000 applications. Some broadcasters, Christian networks primarily, filed for hundreds of translators. Radio Assist Ministry and a partner filed for more than 4,000. The FCC was not particularly troubled when companies began selling translator permits, which it had granted free, mostly to other Christian broadcasters in deals ranging from $2,000 to more than $200,000. If the dealings were of no concern to the FCC, they riled advocates of community radio, such as the Prometheus Radio Project, which had pushed throughout the late 90s for the commission to create a low-power FM radio service that would help to diversify the airwaves. Not all religious broadcasters are behind them. Gloria Tristani, former FCC commissioner, now managing director of the United Church of Christ's Office of Communication, says the companies appear to have broken the spirit, if not the letter, of the rules. A lot of applications were hoarded by companies who were using them to go beyond repeating a local signal, but using them to create networks. That's not what translators were intended for. Much more to the story in the March-April issue of Columbia Journalism Review. Kevin Redding, ABDX, posted this item, that three X-banders are on the way with 450 watts. The FCC has granted three low-power AM licenses to Part15.us on March 31st. Yes, low-power is defined as 450 watts using a half-wave antenna. Many more rules and regulations, which they had not yet gone through when they put out this news. The three stations will be located in Tucson, Arizona, MLR, Seattle, Washington, SCWIS, and Northern New Jersey, MADMAGE, M-A-D-M-A-G-E. More about this at the website part15.us, where, by the way, there is a listing provided by the operators, and no doubt incomplete, of Part 15 radio stations around the U.S. By the way, I'm not totally convinced this item is correct, as I have not seen it confirmed or mentioned anywhere else. We already mentioned on World of Radio a pirate in the Quad Cities of Iowa and Illinois, Power Hits 103.3. In the ABDX list, Darwin Long in California says, I fully support these guys. In a day and age where broadcast professionals incessantly complain about Part 15 emissions from iPods and unlicensed low-power stations, when there are bigger, glaring issues to deal with, the little guy seems to be the one shoved to the side as some dangerous, immoral criminal. It is the FCC's fault for not designating a portion of the AM and FM bands for low-power community broadcasting, as is actually done in other countries, and making it exorbitantly expensive to even get a low-power license. And then their idea of LP is 100 watts to 3 kilowatts to serve a 3 to 8 mile radius, when you only wish to put out 10 watts to do the same job. Broadcasters are simply running scared because of how the tide has turned against the industry the past 5 years with satellite, internet, and podcasting. I hope these two lads make it because they are serving the community actively, getting them involved, unlike your local satellite-fed AM talker or FM translator. Doug Smith from Nashville was visiting Milwaukee and says, driving home from my mom's place in the northwest suburbs, I heard through the grapevine that the new low-power FM, that is a licensed station, WFAQ-LP, is on 92.9. It's in Mukwonago. I'm probably mispronouncing that, in the southwest burbs. So he tuned in 92.9. Their format is not Spanish language rock, but that's what I was hearing from at least I-94 through Mukwonago on I-43. The low-power FM station was heard, too, with a variety of underground music, interesting format. The Hispanic station was a lot louder. If WFAQ was 100 watts, then the pirate was at least 500, and it ought to skip out for DX listening. But no announcements of any kind were heard. Brian Crow, K3VR, has been one of the most vocal critics of Glenn Baxter, K1MAN, who's been in trouble with the FCC for many years, accused of violating amateur rules by broadcasting and advertising. But Brian Crow has some comments about the latest development. Before the majority of the amateur community celebrates K1MAN's forfeiture order, we ought to take the opportunity to evaluate the effectiveness of rules enforcement. There's something more than a bit disturbing about the serious lack of enforcement in this case. The FCC issued notices of apparent liability in 1990 and 91. They were never collected. Nothing at all happened in the K1MAN case for another 8 years, until 1999, when Riley Hollingsworth began writing semi-annual letters to K1MAN. Another 6 years passed without effective enforcement, and in 2005, Baxter received another NAL. Almost a year passed. In 06, he finally received a forfeiture order. The number of years of ineffective enforcement amounts to 21 and counting. If Baxter ignores the order, it appears he intends to, the FCC will be forced to ask the Department of Justice to sue him to recover the $21,000 he owes. How long will the suit take? What are the chances the U.S. attorney will recover the amount? Will it offset the cost of the commission's labor and expenses and the cost of the U.S. attorney's labor and expenses? The FCC began receiving complaints 21 years ago, hundreds of complaints, and 21 years later, he's still on the air. Covering $21,000 will not begin to cover the amount of taxpayer money spent pursuing this rules violator. What does this tell us about the enforcement powers of the FCC? There's been a truly egregious and pathetic lack of any real action in the case. And it tells me the taxpayers are getting royally screwed. I haven't heard that anyone has gotten any enjoyment out of it, with a possible exception of Baxter himself. Terry Kruger sends a story from one of his local newspapers, Dateline St. Petersburg, Florida, April 27th, about the Gandy Bridge and two 490-foot radio towers, which have been battered by many storms, are being downsized to 366 feet. These belong to the 620 station, originally WSUN and now WDAE. Because the towers are 124 feet shorter, they're more wind-resistant and cheaper to build. The signal won't travel as far, so the station plans to boost its power from 10 to 15 kilowatts. The story does not point out that these towers, which have been taken down, are of the historic Blaw Knox design, sort of diamond shape, bulging out in the middle. With our terrible tornadoes, weather is serious business at Oklahoma City TV stations. KWTV has a new helicopter, that's News 9. Their old one was known as Ranger 9, but now a red and black helicopter has a new name, Sky News 9, with a high-definition camera on the nose. It also has 400 more horsepower than the old one and 35 miles per hour faster, can carry five people instead of two. It's a Bell 407 helicopter, top of the line for news aircraft. Average market value is one sesquimegadollar. This story was posted at the Pulse of Oklahoma City, OKCTalk.com. Its competitors, KFOR Channel 4, has an old helicopter of its own, which they make good use of when there's severe weather. Channel 5, however, KOCO, does not have its own chopper, but it's a member of a group, and when there's severe weather, they bring it in from other markets, such as Kansas City. Here's a shortwave item. Craig Christ in Virginia says, I got this from a letter received on April 7th from KJES in Vado, New Mexico. We have a 50-kilowatt shortwave transmitter made by Elcor Electronics from Costa Rica. Our antenna is a CREATE design of Japan rotatable log periodic. It stands 96 feet off the ground. I, Glenn Hauser, have actually been there and seen it. We are 4,394 feet above sea level in the midst of the Chihuahua Desert. We've been on the air since June 22, 1992. The first year was one of constant frustration. The transmitter was a prototype from Elcor. It was the first 50 kilowatt they manufactured. But they say now things are working fine for the most part. We hear them sometimes in the mornings on 11715, in the afternoons on 15385, and maybe in the evenings on 7555. However, I've noticed the modulation is often way down. Finally, some comments from Paul Vincent Zecchino on what he calls Mana Soviet Key, Florida, about IBOC in-band on channel, so-called high-definition radio. In trademark endearing, cut the bull shale manner, have long maintained iBlock is a cheesy, half-baked, ill-conceived, rush-to-market 90s shonk. It's a blatantly sleazy scheme to jam AMs off the air and into bankruptcy, leaving a bile-splat toilet of oleaginous, fecalific grease balls in control of the formerly free flow of information. As with all disingenuous designs to take that which rightfully belongs to others, it will fail miserably. iBlock is unsurpassed as a jammer, should have an atavistic appeal to Fidel's regressed sensibilities. Other than that, have no opinion on the matter. Fred Vobey of the National Radio Club passes on a letter from Steve Davis, chief engineer of Clear Channel Radio, about the aggregate iBlock power. For a 50-kilowatt AM station, it amounts to 2.4 kilowatts, not 500 watts, as had been claimed earlier. So now Wayne Heinen knows why KOA wipes out the entire 800 range in Denver. Glenn Hauser here concluding Continent of Media 0604, also known as World of Radio Extra 68.